Hi, everybody. My name is Maureen Theodore, and I am an lecturer here in the Education Department and also a fellow at the Yale University Art Gallery. Today, this talk is called Land Art in the Long View. And I'll be talking about land art kind of past, present, and into the future. I should start perhaps by saying that I wrote my dissertation on the work of Walter de Maria, who's an artist we'll be talking about today, and that's part of why I'm interested in this topic. Okay, so here I have two images on the screen, a work on the left by de Maria, mile-long drawing, and on the right, Michael Heiser's motorcycle drawings, and you see that these two artists have made drawings in the land. The one on the left is chalk on topsoil, and on the right, it's a motorcycle was driven in circles on this desert earth and made markings. Photographs were then taken of these works, and as you can imagine, they were in the desert. They eventually disappeared. So these are works that happened in the late 60s. They were there for a while to be seen and experienced, but then they kind of turned back into the earth. So in the late 1960s, a number of artists began conceiving of the land as a medium for their work. So in a way, the land becomes a kind of canvas. The works are often located outside the confines of the gallery, far from the conveniences of the city. Artists use non-traditional tools. So here we have the wheels of a motorcycle, for example. The works are meant to be experienced in time, so they have a durational component to it. And the artist whose work is on the right, Walter de Maria, once said something like he wanted his land works to be viewed as one would view a film. So you actually, you know, spend time watching the work, I guess, exist in a kind of frame, a kind of environment. When I say non-traditional tools, these works took artists outside of the enclosed studio and their kind of formal training, and involved extensive research with NASA, with getting permits from different land trusts. So there's all these different tools and machines. They would use bulldozers, front loaders, all different kinds of material, one could say, for the making of these works. So today, oh, and one more thing I want to say is that many of these works exist as documentation. So there's this kind of tension between the work as it was meant to be experienced in the land and the work as it exists in a photograph. So these two ways in which one can interact with the work of art. In all of these works that we're going to look at today, the artists are concerned with time and with space. In a way, we can say that in the second half of the 20th century, artists who would have been focused on objects, or many of them who would have been focused on objects, start thinking about space instead. And that's true for many of the artists we're going to be talking about today. They start also thinking about time and this temporal component to their objects. So I was interested in how these works were thought about when they were first made, and how they're thought about today and experienced today. So in preparation for this talk, I actually I did something I've never done before, which is I kind of crowdsourced on Facebook. I put out a call on Facebook and asked everybody I'm friends with if they'd ever been to any of these remote landworks. And if they had, I asked them if I could interview them, and if they would give me any of their photographs. Most everyone agreed to give photographs and to write a little paragraph about what they had experienced or their understanding of the work. Not that many people were willing to be filmed, so we'll see only one film here. And I asked them a few questions, so this will kind of frame what I was interested in. I asked them to describe how they got to the site. I asked them to define the work of art. So is it the actual site? Is it getting to the site? Is it getting home from the site? I also asked them about the making of the work and how they would define the artist in the scenario. And then I asked them if they took any photographs and how the photographs changed their perception or their memory of the work. And I asked them how their expectations of the work were informed, perhaps by things they had read or things they had seen. This is a trend of working in the land that begins in the late 60s. We saw DeMaria, we saw Heiser, those are both American artists. Artists who were born on the West Coast and come to New York. This is the work of Richard Long, a British artist, A Mile Made by Walking. So this is kind of a, we could say, a somewhat global interest, using the land as a kind of canvas. Here's LeWitt, Saul LeWitt, a report on a cube that was buried. So here he takes a cube and buries it, and we have this documentation in this kind of grid form, 1968. Robert Smithson, a major player, and really, in a way, a kind of spokesperson for this moment. This is a non-site from Franklin, New Jersey. Robert Smithson would take materials from a site that he would find. In this case, it was in New Jersey, and he put it, he brought it into the gallery space and put it in these trapezoid boxes. This is an installation shot from an exhibition called Earthworks at the Dwan Gallery. There we have Virginia Dwan in the upper right-hand corner, and you see the Smithson work next to what looks like a pile of dirt. This is the Earthworks show, one of the first shows that brought these objects together in New York in a gallery space. So here already we see this kind of tension. Artists are interested in working in the land outside the confines of the gallery, and yet, where do you show your work? You show it at a gallery. And ultimately, you hope that your work is bought. So even if you're going against the kind of commodity culture, there's a way in which I think these artists can't help but be complicit with it. Virginia Dwan is a major figure in encouraging these artists to explore what they could do with these works, coming up with the funding to allow these artists to buy land and to rent planes, to explore the kind of the landscape. Another version of this, kind of moving outside of the confines of the gallery, is this move by Donald Judd to buy a huge plot of land in Marfa, Texas. In western Texas, he bought about 340 acres of land, an old army compound, and installed his work there. This work is permanently cited and posthumously is as he installed it himself. So I was interested in how people viewed the experience of seeing these objects, going to view these objects. In the case of going to Marfa, it's not, and any of the other landworks that we'll talk about, for the most part, they're not easy to get to. Marfa is about 3 hours outside of El Paso. So if you are a New York-based art lover, you have to do quite a bit of travel to get there. And here we have this John Waters poster, take the whole family to Marfa, Texas, as if Marfa, Texas is some kind of amusement park. And this was then used as an art forum cover. Once I started doing research for this talk, I realized that there are landworks kind of all over the place. This is a ghost parking lot, which is a kind of land art slash public art project that exists near where I live. Hamden, Connecticut is just north of New Haven. And this was a parking lot for a kind of strip mall from the 1950s. It was very successful in the 1950s. By the 1970s, it was no longer successful. And the shop or the shopping center owner decided that he had to do something to kind of bring this back to life. And he invited an artist to come make an art project in the parking lot. So an artist got these cars donated and sandblasted them, emptied them out, and then covered them with cement. And these cars exist in, some of them still do, I'm told, I actually haven't gone there yet, exist in the parking lot as this art project that can be experienced, and you see on the right people actually experiencing it. And the shopping center owner said that this project actually increased people's use of the stores, and revenue went up after he commissioned it. So the four works that I wanted to focus on today are, on the upper left, we have Walter de Maria's The Lightning Field. On the right, Robert Smithson's The Spiral Jetty. On the left, Michael Heiser's Double Negative. And on the bottom right is James Turrell's Road and Crater. All of these are in the Western states. They're all begun in the late 60s to the late 70s. The one on the right, the Road and Crater, James Turrell bought the land in the late 70s, and it's something that he continues to work on. And when I started thinking about these works together, and perhaps this will frame our conversation, when I think of the one on the upper left, The Lightning Field, and we can talk about this, it's a work for which the experience of it is very mediated and orchestrated. People are invited to, or they can sign up to go to the Lightning Field and visit this field of 400 metal stakes in the desert of New Mexico, and it's a very orchestrated experience. The other alternative is that you can view the photo of it. On the right, we have the Spiral Jetty, which is in the Great Salt Lake of Utah, but not right near Salt Lake City. You actually need to drive about 2 or 3 hours to get there, and this is a counterclockwise coil of basalt rocks that Robert Smithson arranged into the Great Salt Lake, and it's one that has gone in and out of view with the rising waters of the lake. On the bottom left, this Double Negative, where Michael Heiser in the late 60s made two cuts into the land. We can look at some more pictures of it because it's hard to identify here, but there's a cut here about 30 feet wide and 50 feet deep, and a cut over here across a canyon. If you think of what a double negative does, this title, Double Negative, you know, if you put two double negatives in a sentence, you cancel it out and you make a positive. And on the right is Roden Crater, is a 400,000-year-old crater that James Turrell bought to continue his experiments with light and perception. So I'm curious, has anyone been to any of these works? Okay. Have any of you seen these photographs before? Okay. Okay, great. So we can use that to guide our discussion. These works that are sited in the land that are meant to exist for a very, very long time, of course, I think, encourage people to think about other long-standing monuments that we have. On the upper left is ancient monuments in Mexico. On the right is the work of Factor Cheval, a French postman who built this castle made of stone in southern France. And on the bottom right, we have the Nazca lines in Peru, these ancient lines that were made into the earth that still exist today and that can only be seen from the air. So in a way are meant to kind of communicate with the heavens or the sky. So I thought I would start with the work of Walter de Maria, and introduce some of the concepts related to his work, and then perhaps we can talk about them. So this is Walter de Maria in the 1960. He's already writing about art that will exist outside in his essay Art Yard. Not only is he talking about art that will exist outside, but he's also looking for people who will pay for his art outside. And on the right, I apologize for this slide, this is a drawing that he made in 1961 to 64, that he thinks about walls in a desert. He wants to erect these walls in a desert. And then, as I mentioned before, he, in 1968, he is based in New York, as is Michael Heiser, and he gets a gallery show in L.A., and he and Michael Heiser get in a car and drive across the country. And when they get to the desert of California, when they get to Nevada, they're both thinking about what they can do with the earth. And here we have those two parallel lines that de Maria drew in the desert. And we see him lying between these lines, in a way making a statement about how these works should be experienced. And they're photographed by his friend at the time, Michael Heiser. This is a film he made, Two Lines, Three Circles in the Desert. And though the work, like mile-long drawing, wouldn't be seen by many people, this work he intended to be shown on TV. So he was hoping for this to have a wide circulation. He made many more of these. This is Las Vegas piece from 19... Well, not many more. He made a few more, I should say. This is Las Vegas piece from 1969, where he made, with a bulldozer, a cut into the ground so that there was a shape of a right triangle within a larger right triangle. And he wanted people to go to this site, which was hard to find, and then walk this shape and experience the shape through walking it. The way that people write about this is that often they spend such a long time trying to find the site that by the time they haven't found it, they're so frustrated and they don't care about what they might be able to experience in walking this line. Some people would say that this no longer exists and that is something that can happen with these objects. Heiner Friedrich, who is someone who founded the Dia Art Foundation and was another big player in supporting these artists, he claims that it does still exist, but it's very hard to find. De Maria continued thinking about the earth as a material for his work when he created the Munich Earth Room in 1968, and then the New York Earth Room, which we see on the right in 1977. Has anyone here been to the New York Earth Room? Yeah? How can you talk about your experience seeing it? Or being in the space? Does it feel like a work of art, or does it feel like something else? How is it definitely a work of art? Anyone else want to comment on their experience or understanding of the Earth Room? Not what you'd expect from a work of art?
Yeah, not what you expect. It's upstairs, right?
It's on the second floor.
Yeah, not what you expect walking upstairs, and it's in Soho. I just can't remember. And you walk up, and then all of a sudden you're like confronted with this massive room of earth, and it's like humid in there, and you're in the middle of Soho. It's just special.
Yeah. Laura?
Mm-hmm. You can't be in it. You have to observe it kind of from the periphery. But
almost the way you'd observe a landscape or a cliff or something.
Well, I mean, I guess in a landscape you can actually like be mm-hmm. in it, like that photo that you were showing. And mm-hmm. this you kind of have to stand on the side. You can't fully immerse yourself in it, but like the humidity and that kind of mm-hmm. sense of either claustrophobia or scent.
Right.
I
meant more the way you'd observe a landscape painting. Sorry, I wasn't clear. And I think it does have that kind of almost picturesque quality to it. And it is framed. This is plexiglass here.
Holds the dirt in.
It does have a very non-city feel. And one of the people I interviewed for this project told me that whenever he knows someone is coming to New York for the very first time, he gives them the address and just tells them to go there. Not even saying the word earth room, because part of it is just this surprise that something like this exists in the city.
What are the artist's intentions? What does he want us to feel? Or, you know, what is the point?
Well, artists don't usually say, you know, this is what I want you to feel.
Write about it. Sometimes they do.
Walter de Maria is a exceptionally reticent artist and doesn't really talk about his work at all. He wrote a few things in the early 60s, but other than that, he has said very, very little. There's one interview with him from the Archives of American Art, and in that he says things like, art should be among the most powerful experiences you can have in your life, or art should function on 10 different levels. So not in any really specific ways. I think that we can come up with some readings of this. So when he first made this work in Munich in 1968, he was looking at a Munich that was heavily bombed during the Second World War, and there were still all these piles, mounds of dirt, Stückwerks. Perhaps that's what he was thinking when he made the Munich Earth Room originally in 1968. When he remakes it in New York in 1977, I think that if those meanings are embedded in the work on the left, I think that they're no longer in the work on the right. I think many people in New York were very curious about the Munich Earth Room. They'd only seen photographs, and they wanted to experience this work. And it was remade with the support of Heiner Friedrich and the Dia Art Foundation. There are many rules about this work. So de Maria doesn't say very much, but there is a pamphlet that you can get when you go there, and there are facts on this pamphlet. So it will tell you how many cubic centimeters of earth there are, how far up the earth comes, how often it's cleaned. It's raked a lot because mushrooms grow in it. How much it weighs. It's really heavy, as you could imagine. The open and closed hours, those sorts of things, facts. But I think that in presenting all these facts, you're left realizing that the work is really about what you can't say, in a way. I mean, there are these sensations to it. It smells. It's really humid in there. You want to touch it. I know a lot of people who really want to take their shoes off and walk across it, which you're not allowed to do. But I think a lot of it is kind of what you can't articulate, this experience. And that's one of the things that I'm interested in with these works. I think it's very, and your question is a good one. I mean, it's very hard to say, you know, this is what the work means. It's about the experience of it. And when you can actually experience it and you're just viewing a film of it or a photograph of it, what's lost? I mean, what's the quality of the experience that the artist wanted us to have or that we want to have? And I think the ability to go to the New York Earth Room, because it's free, it's open, I think, 9 months out of the year, it's in Soho, it is, you know, a kind of land art, an experience of land art that we can have here.
I was there, mm-hmm. and all I remember about it was my sensation of the odor.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I wish I was on a tour of sorts that somebody could explain, although it may not be accurate, it opens up your mind to what it might or might not be. And the fact that you said it was framed in plexiglass mm-hmm. gave me a different thought about the work, that it wasn't landscape. I didn't look at it like that.
Uh-huh. That it was a yeah. landscape. Hmm. I think, going back to a point that you made, this work, when it was first installed, was in a Soho that was quite different than the Soho we know today. It was one that was populated at the time with artists. There wasn't a fancy designer store on every corner. And more than that, it wasn't this like commodity culture, saturated, commodified culture that Soho is today. And to be in the New York Earth Room now, I think you can't help but think how much it contrasts with what's outside, but also like how expensive this real estate is, and it's filled with dirt. I think that it's very hard not to have that idea. The rules, de Maria is, as I said, reticent. He's also very strict about how his work is viewed. And there are many rules about how one can experience this work. And there's always a guard who's stationed there who can tell you what you can or can't do in the space. And this is the work de Maria made in 1977, The Lightning Field. He did it in collaboration with the Dia Art Foundation, who supported his earth room that we just looked at. He picked a plot of land in near Queimado, New Mexico, which is about 3 hours from Albuquerque. And he, over the course, it took a little over a year, he made this grid of metal stakes that's 1 mile by 1 kilometer. 400 of these metal stakes that are pointed at the top. And even though the terrain is uneven, they're calibrated so that they all reach the very same height, and you could put an imaginary sheet of glass on top of these metal stakes. And people can go to this site and stay in a log cabin that's nearby, and you stay there for 24 hours, and you watch the field and experience the field over this 24 hours. So to come back to this idea of time, time is written into your, is a requirement of experiencing this work of art. There's the log cabin on the right. And here are some photographs that I took when I went there. You can see on the left that the boots are covered in mud. So this is this really wet dirt, or it was when I was there anyway. So that walking the field was actually a very, very difficult process. Every time you stepped down, your foot was kind of caked into the ground, and you needed to then lift your foot up. You can see how wet it is on the side. And then over the course of the day, the field changes, and these stakes take on different colors. This is the sunrise on the left. The Center for Land Use Interpretation put out some maps so that people could find this site on the off-season if they just wanted to show up on their own. And the Dia Art Foundation took many of them down with the idea that no, like, renegade person should go off on their own and find this site, that the experience of it should always be highly orchestrated. Your arrangements should be made through Dia. And when you get there with this 24-hour stay, 6 people are allowed to go at once. They provide you with meals. They have you sign a waiver in case you get bitten by a rattlesnake. You're not allowed to take any photographs, although everyone does. People even take videos. And being in this space, being in a place for that long, makes you so aware of your surroundings. So as you can see here, I mean, in the work on the right, if you look closely, you can see the metal stakes, but they almost get erased by the positioning of the sun. You hear everything. I mean, you hear the way that wind sounds on the brush. You hear the sound of a bird's wings flapping. I mean, you hear things that you would not hear if you were in the city, and that's part of the work, part of what DeMaria is after. So is anyone familiar with this work, Double Negative? Yeah? This is a work that Michael Heiser made in 1969. He did it with the help of Virginia Dwan. I think she paid about $9,000 to buy many acres of land outside of Overton, Nevada, which is not too far from, a couple hours from Las Vegas. And with bulldozers, as I was saying before, he made these 2 cuts in the earth. Here it is, the aerial view, and you can see these 2 cuts and then the valley in between. So one of the people who I asked for, I asked to talk about their experience at the site was a student of mine, Julia Novich, and she took a trip to Double Negative, and she talked about getting there. And the first day she drove there, she drove from California, and it took all day. And she ended up stopping her car about a mile from the site because she didn't think her car could make it over the terrain. So she walked the rest of the way. And as you can see, originally the cuts were these really sharp cuts into the earth. But over time, boulders and brush has fallen down or grown up, completely changing the environment of this work. So there she is in one of these cuts, which gives you a sense of the scale of the work. She said, "The site itself is unmarked, and we spent a half an hour or so in search of it. The second time we visited the site, 3 or 4 days later, we drove much closer. Both times we were surprised by how quickly we walked up to the cuts themselves without realizing that they were there, right in front of us, until we were practically standing at their edges, in part because the cuts are so level with the ground, and the ground is so flat." She talked about the experience of being in the work of art as totally terrifying. The only way that she said that there's the sound of wind and the feel of wind inside the cuts is quite strong, and there's this, you know, kind of vulnerability where you realize that these pieces can fall down on you. So in a way, perhaps Heiser is accessing some kind of sublime, some kind of terrifying encounter with nature. And he does not want this work to be conserved, so it was originally owned by Virginia Dwan. She tried to sell it at a point shortly after he made it, and he wouldn't let her. And she eventually gave the work to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, and they maintain it, and they talk about their stewardship of it as similarly to if a museum got a period room, that they would take on this period room. Except in this case, Heiser has asked that the work not be conserved at all. And you can imagine what that means. But eventually, the sides will fall in, and this work will kind of turn back into the earth. So this work exists for us now in an altered state than it did before. And eventually, it will exist really only in photographs. The American photographer, Mark Ruedel, has taken photographs of the changing landscape of the United States. He's taken photographs of old train lines. He's also photographed the cut of Michael Heiser, and you can see that in a silhouette against the sky. Here's another work by Heiser, which is, when we talk about time, this is a good example of one that is long-lasting and ongoing. He began it in 1972, and it continues. A work that one wonders if he'll ever complete it. And a work that many compare to the ancient monuments of Mexico, for example. So something that, even if it isn't completed, it will exist for perhaps centuries to come. So I wanted to look at one last work by Michael Heiser, and one that many of you might be familiar with. This past summer, this work, Levitated Mass by Michael Heiser, was installed in Los Angeles. Did anyone read anything about this? No? I'm going to show a video of... So this is a work that Michael Heiser conceived of about 40 years ago, which was to take a monolithic rock from the earth and to display it in a museum situation. So he found the rock, and then he had it transported to the museum, to a museum in Los Angeles. There is the rock on a trailer. So this is the work being pulled along the trail to the city. That's the rock. And the excitement of its delivery, in a way we could say, became part of the experience. So this work presently exists in Los Angeles, and you can see that it is propped up by this steel structure, and there's this pathway, almost like one of the cuts we just saw, and people can walk under it. So here we have, almost like the earth room, an example of the earth being moved into a city environment. Here's the planning that went in to create this. I asked someone who had gone to see this work how he would think about, how he thought about the work of the artist. And he said, in this instance, the artist is a curator, taking this object from somewhere else and installing it into a museum environment.
Do they put in any warnings, like if somebody is going to a place like this, that you shouldn't do it if you're not well, or
like the double negative?
Yeah.
I think there are lots of warnings associated with the double negative, and I've read that the Museum of Contemporary Art asks that people register with the local police department, like the last police department that you can, that you'll see before you get to double negative, because I guess you don't know what's going to happen while you're there. I mean, it's not a contained work in the way that, you know, a painting might be framed. So yeah, there's certainly some warnings involved, but there's also an element of it being this. I think that these artists in some way kind of saw themselves as these kind of cowboys, and the experience of going to see them has that kind of alternative, perhaps risky culture associated with it. And I would say that going to see Double Negative does carry some risks with it. And I think we could say perhaps that's part of the work. When you go to the Lightning Field, they have you sign documents saying that you won't sue them if you get hurt, if you get struck by lightning, if you get bitten by a rattlesnake. And that's not going to happen to you while you're looking at paintings here, I don't think.
What about the earth room? Because you say it's claustrophobic.
That wasn't my experience of it. Someone else said it was, you found it claustrophobic. Not oppressively so. It almost, it's almost spa-like, but then it smells like dirt, like
yeah.
That kind of heat. Aware of the volume. Mm-hmm.
But claustrophobia isn't something that is necessarily, in kind of a general term, isn't something that's like dangerous.
Right. I guess maybe, yeah, if you, yeah, I wouldn't say that claustrophobia is dangerous. And the, I think the idea of danger comes back to this idea of the sublime that was written about by Kant, by Burke, that you have these terrifying encounters with nature, and it, the sublime is, or artists attempted to depict the sublime in paintings of the West, for example, and perhaps that's one of the traditions that these artists are continuing. You had a comment.
Uh-huh. Both with the cut in the land, and also I remember watching the video of the installation of the ellipses the last time they were here,
mm-hmm.
and sort of that the big spectacle that made to bring them down the avenue. Has there been any connection, any conversation with Richard Serra and
Michael Heiser?
Yeah.
You mean the two of them? Like, have they been in conversation? Well, that brings up a number of interesting points. I mean, for many of these works, I think that a lot of the work that's been done is the kind of like travel log, or the personal experience of going to view one of these works for which you make a kind of pilgrimage to. And that really goes against a scholarly treatment in a way. In the case of Richard Serra, he has certainly received some scholarly treatments. And there's, critics and historians and theoreticians who have thought a lot about his work. Serra and Heiser and DeMaria and Smithson are sometimes talked about together. I don't know if she mentions all three of them, but Rosenkraus wrote an important essay called Sculpture in the Expanded Field, where she talks about how the definition of sculpture just opens wide up around the 1970s, and all of these artists are part of that opening up. So reconceiving of what sculpture is and what it can be, and very often it involves some kind of durational or temporal component and this experiential element. I think you could certainly do a comparison of Heiser and Sarah. I don't know the nature of the relationship between Heiser and Sarah. I know that when Robert Smithson and Walter DeMaria were both kind of coming up as artists, they were very competitive with one another and actually like deeply disliked each other. I know that Walter DeMaria and Michael Heiser were close friends for a while and then not friends at all. And I know that Michael Heiser had made some comments, and I don't know if this is something he would repeat today, but I know he's made some comments that, like, I had the idea to go out in the land and then everybody copied me. So there is certainly this sense that many artists are coming to these similar ideas at the same time, but they're realizing it in different ways, I think we can say. The cuts in the land that we saw, the double negative by Heiser, I can certainly think of cuts with steel that Richard Serra has made that I can see a connection to. Richard Serra's works are usually more publicly accessible, the ones that I can think of.
When you talked about the experience of being in the, I recall my own experience of being in the metal pathways.
Yeah, and how would you describe that experience?
I think, the idea of the danger, the element, I remember being aware of mm-hmm. the massiveness
right.
Of the metal and just thinking, you know, while I trust this was constructed well, it's always that possibility, that looming presence of it, and I would imagine that the feel is sort of the same when you walk under that room.
Right. And remember, those first works that we looked at, those drawings by DeMaria, he wanted those to be walls. And that would be very similar to the work of Richard Serra, which, if you're not familiar with his work, he makes these walls that are sometimes curved, sometimes not, of often Corten steel. And they stand often on their own gravity. They are balanced so that they don't appear to be connected to the ground in any way. It is through mathematics and engineering that they stand securely. And they do tend to stand securely. But I thought the same thing when I saw that video of levitated mass. I thought of when Torque Ellipse came here and when other Sarahs have moved places. It is a big, big production. And a production that involves like the world of machines and building and industry in a way that we're not necessarily always used to in when we think of traditional art. So now I wanted to look at the work of Robert Smithson, who's probably the most well-known of all of these land artists. And I think this is an early work that he did where he brings earth into the gallery, and here where he brings these mirrors into the land on the right. This, of course, is the work he's most well known for, Spiral Jetty, a work he made in 1970. And I was interested in looking at Smithson in particular, well, for a lot of reasons, but one, because many of the works of these artists end up being unfinished. So Heiser's City may not be finished in his lifetime. Terrell's Roden Crater may not be finished in his lifetime. Robert Smithson finished Spiral Jetty, but he always wanted it to be, he was interested in the idea of entropy, that natural forces would cause the work to degrade. And he was accepting of those natural forces so that this work would change over time. Another work that he created, called Amarillo Ramp, which we can look at in a moment, actually, he didn't complete during his lifetime. He died in a plane crash over the work as he was going to complete it. And his wife, Nancy Holt, completed the work. And that work hasn't received any conservation. And it is, it's almost sad when you go to see it. Like, you don't get the quality of experience that Smithson was probably after. And it really brings up some questions about these works in a span of time, even if the artists gave specific instructions that they didn't want their work conserved. If in the case of Spiral Jetty, oil rigs are going to be installed near this work, or if the stones that he moved are going to be so degraded that they'll no longer have this deep red color that he was so fond of, does it make sense to replace the stones, for example? So this is a work for which Smithson, you can see him here, photographed with it. He made a film about this work. He had many photographs documenting the making of this work. It is now maintained by Dia. At a certain point about 2 years ago, Dia's lease ran out for this work, and the state of Utah claimed it was taking it over, although I believe that dispute has now been settled. And you can just go to this work. Unlike De Maria's work, you don't need to make a reservation in advance. You just kind of show up. And for this, I talked to a friend of mine who one day had a free day in Salt Lake City, and he decided to go to Spiral Jetty. And he drove there by himself. He took a photo of this coyote he found along the way. And then he got to the jetty and realized he went there by himself and then was there by himself. So in a manner in which we would probably never find ourselves in New York, he's at this, you know, major art site all alone. And he said he put on sandals and then walked this spiral. And he talked about this, you know, being out in the open land and then kind of circling in and then circling back out. And then when he was done, and these are the rocks that there's some question as to whether they should be replaced.
Was the basalt specifically indigenous to the area, or is that why he selected to use
Yeah, so he moved rocks from the Great Salt Lake into this coil configuration. And as he was leaving and driving back, he had heard that if you make, I think, a left instead of a right on your way back, you come upon this place where they make rockets. And he was just shocked by, you know, being in one moment this work, and then in the next this one, that was very much organized as a kind of museum with interpretive material where they told you the dimensions of the work of the rocket, what they were made of, how they might be used. And with the Spiral Jetty, there's nothing but that introductory sign. I know. Do you have any? Have you been to the Spiral Jetty, Charles?
No.
No? Do you want to add anything about?
I was curious about one thing that you've said. That you mentioned that you think of these as alternative versions of the artwork. In other words, the photograph and the actual site.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that it's a funny inherent irony that, on the one hand, the you know, if you think about the sculpture in an expanded field and opening up the what can be a piece of sculpture,
mm-hmm.
if, as these artists began with in the beginning, trying to make larger ideas about sculpture, that on the one hand, they've created a kind of exclusivity of the actual experience of the physical reality of
right.
the thing, where at the same time they've made a kind of, let's say, popularization through media of the image of the thing. And I wondered how you thought about that in terms of what is actually the artwork. And there's, I think, obviously it's the situation where you go individually in nature and have a very sublime experience of this particular work, this very unique experience, but it's also very exclusive in a certain way. I mean, it's very controlled, for instance, in the De Maria situation.
Right.
It's so orchestrated in a certain way.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that it's not even contradictory to the actual meaning of the sublime work of an individual's confrontation with nature.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of told you should experience it this way, for instance. I wonder how you thought about some of those things.
So I think the De Maria work is highly controlled and orchestrated, and I think that can go either way for people. I think that really bothers some people, that it's so organized. But part of it is that De Maria wants you to spend a long period of time with his work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's controlled, but kind of controlled for a reason. It is exclusive because it costs money to get there, and there's very few people who live three hours outside of Albuquerque in this town and can easily make it there. So I think that there's certainly a level of exclusivity. Same with the spiral jetty, though. I mean, it may not be controlled. And DIA is very open. They say, you know, we rely on people's common sense. We know that people don't always use common sense, but we hope that they will. And there have been some vandalism has happened there. But that's exclusive, too, because, again, it is remotely sited, and it's meant to be remotely sited. And Smithson chose that spot because of what kind of vistas you'd have around the site. I think it's a conflict, you know, that the experience of it is so important, and that so much of how people experience this work is through documentation, where you're not going, you'll have an experience, but not that sublime experience. I was going to say one other thing that's escaping me now, but maybe it'll come back to me. I mean, in some ways, I think it's surprising and wonderfully surprising that these two DiMaria works exist and are open in New York, that you can just go to them and you don't have to pay anything. You can just wander in. It's the Earth Room and also this other work called The Broken Kilometer. Both of them are in Soho, run by DIA. And when DIA was having financial troubles a couple decades ago, they thought about closing these two works and selling the land, the buildings, but they chose not to. And I think that that shows a commitment to this kind of experience. And maybe that's partly knowing that it's really so hard to get to the Lightning Field. I think about 700 people go a year. This is what I was going to say. So when DiMaria made that work, he commissioned a photographer named John Cleet to take the photographs of the work. And the reason why they chose John Cleet, apparently they interviewed lots of people, including Ansel Adams. John Cleet agreed to give over the copyright for these photographs. And DiMaria and DIA wanted to completely control the copyright. And they released, out of many, many photos, they released only about 5 of them. And they all capture this kind of sublime, this erratic quality of the field. So that is clearly very important to them. And someone wrote, maybe it's Robert Hughes, wrote something like, I'm not sure that a photograph can ever live up to the experience of the Lightning Field. And actually, I'm not sure that an experience of the Lightning Field can live up to the photograph. So I think the quote is basically like that, but that the photo is creating this experience that really isn't going to happen. It's something else. So yeah, there's lots of ways in which the works exist. Yeah. I think this Smithson was the one who was most comfortable with the kind of mediated quality of his work. Would you agree?
I think he made he could make an adjustment to the gallery. The non-site is really conceptual, mm-hmm. dislocation of the landscape.
Right.
In a very definite way. He makes a choice.
Right. And Smithson also wrote extensively, so he had an opportunity to kind of present his ideas with words. So I'm just going to finish up by showing you some photographs of Amarillo Ramp, and I think it introduces some questions about the finished work or the non-finished work and what we can kind of expect for these works for the future. So this is Amarillo Ramp shortly after Smithson made it, or shortly after it was finished, around 1973, 74. And this is what it looks like today. So really just a kind of far cry from what it was originally. It was meant to have water in its center. It's this sloping rock. And someone has come in and painted some of these rocks green, as you can see. But the experience of the work and the way the work exists now is really probably not at all as Smithson intended. So I'm going to finish up now, but I would hope that if you have questions, if you'd like to pose them, I'm happy to stick around if you have any comments to make about the works that we looked at and discussed. Thank you. Thank you.